Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host. Joining me on this episode is Chris Marshall of the Collected Comics Library. How are you doing tonight, Chris?
Good, John. It's good to be back.
Cool. It's good to have you. It's always great. As always, we're going to take a look at the estimated sales for the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, hardcovers, and other collected editions. And this time around, it's going to be the April 2007 data. Okay, I want to do a couple of quick caveats before we get into the stuff this time. Quick note for new listeners. These numbers you're about to hear are based on the sales from Diamond to retailers in the North American direct market, and do not include mass market outlets like Borders and Amazon. Furthermore, keep in mind these are just estimates. Actual sales to retailers may be higher. The actual sales to readers may be lower. I also want to remind everyone that the numbers we're discussing are based on a limited data set and do not reflect all of the sales from Diamond to retailers. It only contains the data that's been released on the top trades and graphic novels list over the past few years. Currently, that only has 100 items. A few years back, it only had 10. It isn't a perfect data set, but it's the best one currently available for the direct market, and it gives us a pretty good sense of what's selling and what's not. Now, Chris, this month, why don't we change things around a little and start with a quick look at the market shares and the news before we get into the top-selling graphic novels, trades, and other collected editions.
Sounds good. It was a banner month for Marvel this month, eh?
Oh, totally. Totally. Marvel just took it away. They had, by dollars, they had over 51% of the market share. By units, they had a little over 45.5%. And that's staggering. For comparison, DC came in second, which is no surprise, but a distant second this time. They only had 22% by units and a little over 25% by dollars. In both areas, that's half what Marvel did of the market share. And, I mean, this is, I think, one of the first times we've seen a really, really lopsided splitting of the pie for the market share. Well, I think it's pretty obvious, and we'll go over this once we get into the actual top trades, that Civil War was, you know, all of what did that, not all of it, but most of it, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you see a almost 2-to-1 difference in units and in dollars, it's, you know, between Marvel and DC, no less, it's just amazing.
Has either company done this well before? Got a 45 to 51% by, you know.
On the trade side?
Yeah, on the trade side. You've been doing this for a long time, so.
I don't think so. Usually it's more of an even split between Marvel, DC, and everyone else.
Yeah.
More of a kind of almost a 30-30-30 sort of thing.
Well, I know in the past year, we've been doing this for a good year now, and I've never seen numbers like that.
Yeah. I can't think of any case where any company has had, you know, a 51% market share. It's just insane.
Well, then either, and if you want to, skip down to number three.
Number three, Viz, it had just under 11% by units and only about 5% by dollars, 5.25,
yeah.
Let's say.
So by units, that's half of what DC had. So it's, I mean, that just tells you no other company even came close.
Oh, yeah. Well, and by dollars, I mean, over, yeah, 75% of the market's there, Marvel and DC.
Right.
And by units, that's what, 68% thereabouts. So,
but when I look at those numbers, Marvel and DC combined, they never have 75% market share.
Not on the trade side. Yeah, last month DC came on top with 30% units. Marvel had 23.
Right.
If we go back a month prior to that, going back to February, it was about 36% for DC by units. 28 or so for Marvel. Let's
go right, so in that 70% range. I mean, it's still...
They still do well.
Yeah, still do well.
Not just dominating.
Right.
And again, going back to January, it's about 36% for DC and about 28 for Marvel.
Okay.
So, I mean, they're doing a decent chunk of it, but each one is still well under that 40%.
Right.
For any company in any month to do 45% by units and again, over 51% by dollars of the top 100 trades. Mm-hmm. It's often been said that, you know, so goes Marvel, so goes the industry. Typically, that's more been along on the comic side. Certainly this month, no question about it being also true on the trade side. But, I mean, this is, again, unprecedented success for Marvel. Civil War did really well on the comic side. Now we're seeing those things coming through the channel on the trade paperback side.
Mm-hmm. April was also the month, if I'm not mistaken, that Captain America number 25 came out, right? I think it did the last week of...
No, it was the previous month. It came out
March. Okay.
In this month, we had the Fallen Son.
Yeah, okay, I was just wondering if they combined in comic book stores a big Civil War trade paperback rack with the Initiative comics coming out, or the Death of Captain America or Fallen Son. I know Comic City, where I go to up here near my house, that's what they have. They've got a giant display just of Civil War. And then next to that, they've got a giant one of 52 and Countdown right now.
Hmm. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that's really confusing me a little, I'd love to get your perspective on this, on the packaging on the trade paperbacks, particularly for Civil War, and how they had the common trade dress on the monthly comics. What I'm noticing on the trades is you've got a lot of them, Civil War, Civil War Amazing Spider-Man, Civil War Frontline, Civil War Fantastic Four, Civil War X-Men, Civil War Thunderbolts. Civil War is the title along with whichever book it came out of.
Correct.
Yet for a couple other things, you've got Heroes for Hire Volume 1, Civil War is the subtitle.
Right. They did this Blade was the same way, yeah.
Punisher You're War right. Journal, things like that. And what I'm seeing is anytime they put Civil War in the subtitle versus the title, it's going to be a lot lower down on that list. I mean, on a few of these cases, Heroes for Hire was that. I mean, yeah, it was tied into Civil War pretty much. I mean, no, not really any less so than some of these other titles. I would say Thunderbolts certainly, again, was a major part of Civil War, but so was Punisher War Journal. Mm-hmm. So I don't understand why the decision was made to brand some things more prominently with Civil War than others.
Yeah, I can't answer that. That's a good question. I was wondering that myself. And also, I was also wondering when I read my list off from week to week and my new releases a week list, you know, when I read like Civil War such and such book, they have different price points and they've ranged from $12 all the way up to $18 depending on what trade. I think the Captain America one maybe $18 and the Iron Man and Marvel Universe trades that come out today are at $12. And the price ranges are all over the place. And we can go into that more in depth when we run down the list in a minute.
Yeah, actually, I've got a question on the pricing on one of the items specifically that I'm curious about. And we'll get to that in a little bit.
But it's also interesting how they've been packaging Civil War, too. For instance, coming out today, Civil War Iron Man collects Iron Man 13 and 14. And then the Iron Man Captain America Casualties of War special, and then Civil War The Confession. Well, the Captain America Iron Man book could have easily been in the Captain America book, you know what I mean?
So yeah, but they had so little with Iron Man, they had to put something there.
Exactly. They're kind of filling it, that's my point. And also with the Marvel Universe book, got Civil War Choosing Sides, The Return is in this book, and The Initiative, and She-Hulk number 8 is also in this book.
Interesting.
And if I'm not mistaken, I'll have to look it up, but I think She-Hulk had her... Did she have her own trade of Civil War?
I don't think so, because she went to World Without a Hulk or whatever for the last couple of months. That was a four-issue run of the title.
No, here it is. She-Hulk Volume 4, Laws of Attraction, with the subtitle of Civil War, collected She-Hulk number 6 through 13. So that had already previously been collected, number 8.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, they're just trying to fill it.
I just find it confusing, though, with some of these, because I prefer the Heroes for Hire, where you've got the Volume 1, Volume 2, Volume 3, to where if I'm looking at these things on a rack, I would know what order to read them in, or specifically in my case, when I'm trying to compare things to how the previous volume did, I would know what the previous volume was.
Right.
But like the Civil War Amazing Spider-Man, what trade do I compare that to for the previous one, if any? It makes sense to brand it this way to keep the Civil War stuff together and as a unit and hopefully bump the sales up. But it's a case where the crossover is clearly overpowering the individual titles and the continuity they had going on the trades.
Right.
It's a tough position. I mean, there is no necessarily right or wrong answer. Clearly putting Civil War as the main title makes sense and has helped the sales. Mm-hmm. But I gotta wonder if long term this is gonna cause headaches for retailers on how they shelf the products, and you know, if people know what one to look for. You know, because I mean, some of these are gonna have had a volume prior to the Civil War. They're going to have a volume afterwards. Are they going to be consecutively numbered? Is there going to be a number missing because it was the Civil War volume? How's that all going to play out?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's maybe up to the retailer. You're right.
Yeah, this is just the sort of thing that drives me nuts.
Well, the one thing that drove me nuts was the recent Daredevil trades. You know how Brubaker took over Daredevil? And he was up to, I think, volume 8 or 9 of the trades, maybe more, and then all of a sudden it became number 1. Just
that's
because
right.
Ed Brubaker took over.
Because I'm looking at Volume 2 or whatever, which is the
volume
second
two, right.
Brubaker one. But it's funny, because they've essentially renumbered the trades, but not the monthly.
Yes.
From my vantage point, it's shooting themselves in the foot. I mean, not right now. Obviously, these things are going to sell how they're going to sell.
Right.
But 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, or even in the bookstores, this is just asking for people to get confused. And they should be making it as simple as possible to follow. You know, okay, I read this one, I liked it, what's next? It shouldn't be hard to answer that question.
Well, that's why, I mean, we can get in a whole debate, or not even a debate, because you and I would probably agree, but the whole discussion on renumbering titles. I mean, look at Thunderbolts. I mean, you know, they get up to, like, what, issue 70, 75, and then, wham, they're number one, and then they hit, like, you know, issue 101, you know, and they get renumbered to their original numbering system.
Yeah.
Fantastic Four have the same thing. I mean, it's just, it gets to be silly after a while.
Yeah, they renumber something to get the bump from the low or the low numbers. The minute the sales, I don't say the minute the sales go down, because that's not what's happening.
That's
the
not
minute
what's right.
It's convenient. They flip the numbering back to the original numbering to where it looks like they're a long-established, you know, hey, we've been around for 400 or 500 issues.
Right.
They're trying to have it both ways.
And it looks like they're doing that on the trades now with Brubaker's Daredevil.
Yeah.
The same could be said. You know, oh, new story arc, new direction. Well,
you know, that's going to be... I was going to say it'd be interesting to watch on, like, Ultimate Spider-Man, but I guess Bendis is Stang. But if he'd switched and they flipped it to, you know, another... number one for the trade on that, that would just, it's, again, it's confusing.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, it's bad enough we have four or five, you know, Captain America number ones to be had.
Yeah.
Probably only four out of the five, I guess. But now to have two volume ones of the Daredevil trades, you know, not to be confused with the hardcovers or the premier hardcovers or an omnibus or, you know, whatever. It's like,
right.
This is, it's not a major barrier to entry, but it is a barrier to entry.
Right.
And one that doesn't really need to be there.
And I don't want to be, you know, when a title is changed, though, it's different. You know, when JSA became Justice Society of America, or JLA became Justice League of America with Meltzer just recently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's different. I understand that.
Yeah, but in both of those cases, it's kind of funny because I think those were destined to flip.
Yes.
Because the minute they were started as JLA and JSA, it became, I don't want to say an in-joke, but insider knowledge.
Yes.
If you were a new reader looking at it and you see the letters JSA, you got no clue what the hell that means.
Right.
So the fact they flipped it back to the full spelled-out title and stuff, I'm not the least bit surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I would just be happy if now they've gone back to Justice League of America, that at least on the inside in the Indicia or whatever, they would put Volume 2.
Is it? I was going to say, is it Volume 2 now?
It's the second volume. It's not labeled as such.
Right.
Publishers, Marvel and DC in particular, but a lot of the other ones, don't track what volume they're on. They don't put that on the comic.
No.
And between that and variant covers, at times it can be kind of confusing until you actually start going into the issue as to which comic this really is.
Well, I mean, we could have a whole discussion again about, you know, the, you know, Legion of Superheroes and Teen Titans and everything. So anyway, we're kind of dragging, so we should probably...
Why don't we hit the news? Because you had a couple of good things that
let's hit
that
the
came
news. What do you want to start with? 300?
Yeah, let's start with 300.
All right, this came from ICB2.com on June 1st. It was reported that 300 dominates quarter one graphic novel sales. Spurred on the success of the movie adaptation, Frank Miller's 300 dominated the sales of graphic novels in both the direct and bookstore markets during the first quarter of 2007, according to research conducted by ICV2. Dark Horse's $30 hardcover edition of 300 had already racked up well over 1.5 million in retail sales in the bookstores alone, although Naruto Volume 13 recently passed 300 in unit sales. 300 was the number one graphic novel in units for the first quarter and only recently relinquished its lead, which it could possibly regain when the 300 DVD is released.
And that's going to be, the DVD is going to be out end of July?
End of July, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. Because, I mean, again, on the direct market side, 300 came in with really strong reorders of about 4,100 units, putting it at known sales in the direct market of, you know, 29,700. But I gotta stress that that is a low figure. Mm-hmm. This book originally came out at the tail end of 1999, at which point Diamond... But yeah, I am not the least bit surprised this book did gangbusters in the mass market outlets. Mm-hmm. 1.5 million, you know, is, if anything, I would think almost potentially a little low. Because any bookstore worth its salt, you know, Borders, Barnes & Noble, whatever, is going to take advantage of having a hardcover. They're going to put it front and center. It's going to be obvious to go look at. The fact that the movie was good and that it was very faithful to the comic book. I mean, if you like the movie, you're going to like the comic book, or the hardcover in this case. So, I mean, that's just a win all the way around. So I think that's great. You know, and I'm glad to see it's doing well, again, both in the mass market and in the direct market. I hope that comic book store retailers are taking advantage of any customers coming in looking for it and are able to transition them to other appropriate works. Move on to the other item you had.
Yeah, I just want to follow up. You know, it's been discussed. I know, I think we've talked about it before, and I know it's been discussed on other podcasts and even in the media, that, you know, one of these days, you know, movie companies and movie theater companies are going to get wise to this whole superhero tie-in. And, you know, it would be prudent on their part to set up shop in the lobby and sell a bunch of books when people got released from the theater or are standing in line waiting for a ticket. You know, they could walk over and, you know, buy, look at the Spider-Man books, or whatever the movie happens to be. And they can go and say, hey, you know, this would be cool, you know, and learn more about the characters and you know, and showcase some of their good stuff. I mean, you know, what I'm just thinking of, you know, the Fantastic Four movie coming out and the long lines. And if you had a retailer there, a local comic book guy, you know, in the lobby, and he's got like five or six omnibuses, I bet he'd sell them all. You know, and he could take a credit card order. I bet he'd sell them.
Well, omnibuses, essentials,
yeah,
you know, half a dozen different things. Stuff for all the price points, all the different levels of quality of the art, the printing,
Marvel Adventure books for the kids that are there.
Exactly.
You know, hey, this is kid-friendly right here, where this is more expensive, it's more adult, you know, and this is the ultimate line. You know, just showcasing everything that has to do with those characters.
I mean, it's a great idea, and I totally support it. It's just a matter of logistics.
Right.
The comic book retail market is predominantly filled by standalone or really small chain stores of, you know, maybe a half dozen locations or whatever. I guess there may be a few that have more than that. Mm-hmm. But by and large, you're talking mom-and-pop stores that, you know, would have to take on the risk of getting all the material, set up the shop after they've coordinated all this stuff with the theater and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. I mean, there's potential for big-time gain.
But even if you only had to do it the opening weekend, you know, Friday night, Saturday night, close up shop. You know, don't do it Sunday. Just Friday night, Saturday night. That's all you got to do. You know, come in. I mean, you don't even have to set up at 1 in the afternoon. I'm talking like set up at 4 in the afternoon, close at 9, 10 o'clock, 12 hours in total.
Yeah, do it for the opening weekend. Yeah.
Do it for the opening weekend. You know, get the nighttime crowd. That's all you got to do.
Yeah. No,
I don't think it would be that hard to do. Maybe I'll start it.
I think Marvel and DC should be doing more in terms of the agreements they make when they license out their characters, mm-hmm. to where there's something fairly prominent at the beginning of the movie. I mean, the little Marvel logo with the flipping comic stuff is cool and whatnot, but there ought to be something that really, I don't want to say hammers home, but you know, lets people know that this really cool movie you're about to see started as a comic book, and there's a lot more really cool stuff in comics these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely an untapped audience.
And the story continues in the comic books.
Yeah.
Oh, also, 300 DVD comes out August 1st.
August 1st, okay.
Okay, let's move on to Mouse Guard. Mouse Guard collection, over 25,000. This came out on ICV2.com on June 5th, a few days ago. Archaea Press hardcover Mouse Guard collection has already sold over 25,000 copies since its release last month, according to publisher Mark Smiley. The largest portion, around 11,000 in initial orders, went to bookstores and libraries. About 7,000 went to comic stores, and 5,000 are going to the Science Fiction Book Club. Another 4,000 to 5,000 copies worth of readers have already been placed. Another 4,000 to 5,000 copies worth of reorders have already been placed.
I was going to say, that's really interesting about the Science Fiction Book Club. I mean, if they did about 5,000 and the direct market itself did only about 7,000, it seems like there's, again, an untapped audience there. Because, I mean, Mouse Guard is brilliant, don't get me wrong. But when I think of Mouse Guard, I don't think Science Fiction Book Club. And if the Science Fiction Book Club readers are going after something like Mouse Guard, there's a ton of stuff they would really love.
It's more, I've not read Mouse Guard, but it's more in the vein of Lord of the Rings, isn't it?
Lord of the Rings, kind of a Camelot kind of a
Camelot,
thing.
Camelot, right, yeah.
You know, it's Arthurian Knights-ish sort of thing. It's not, you know, Arthurian legend type stuff, but it's that sort of thing with mice. It is not the least bit science fiction-y. Yeah, having that huge of an order through the Science Fiction Book Club is just staggering, particularly, again, in comparison to the comic stores. I'm not in the least bit surprised that the bookstores and libraries accounted for the lion's share, you know, with that 11,000. The minute I saw this series, you know, because I was getting it in the monthly format or whatever.
Oh, you get everything, John.
Well, not everything, just a lot. But it really struck me as something that would just do awesome in a hardback format. Mm-hmm. It's got kind of that storybook quality to it in all the right ways. The fact that the form factor was unusual for a comic book, I think, I don't want to say hindered its sales in the comic book market, because, my God, the thing was doing, you know, 10,000 units or whatever every issue. It did gangbusters for, you know, an unknown, independent, odd-sized book. So this is something that really has the potential of sticking around for the long haul, being kind of the next Bone, the next, you know, Akiko or whatever, you know, kind of fits in that all ages fantasy-ish, you know, kind of thing. So this is awesome to hear. Now, this was released in May, so that's not going to be in the numbers we're going to look over this time, but next time around we should see that 7,000. But again, both of these articles you found, Chris, really point out that, you know, what we're looking at is a subset of the sales. We're looking at how stuff's doing in the direct market, and some things are going to do really, really well in the mass market. Other stuff may not even show up there or do, you know, negligible sales there. But again, you know, everything's going to sell differently based on strength of the brand, the property, etc.
Yeah, Mouse Guard has a retail price of $25, and I don't have a page count. Probably 190 pages that I'm gathering.
What I really liked about the monthly format is there were no ads.
Right.
You know, it was it was a nice package. Great looking art. You really ought to check it out. I think you'd
like it. I will. No, I will, definitely. All right.
Shall we go through the top 100?
Yes, and those links we will have in the show notes as well for everybody to read.
I will definitely try, yes. And if I forget, you'll remind me and have them on your notes.
That's right.
Let's start at the top. Go ahead and discuss that Civil War trade paperback that came in at rank number one with about 19,200 units. This is really good for opening numbers. To say this thing launched strong is, of course, no surprise. This is the fifth highest launch on record for trade paperbacks and collected editions. And it launched into the 24th best-selling trade on record. Mm. And again, this is opening numbers. Now, just for comparison, the other things that launched higher than this, for collected editions were the JLA Liberty and Justice Oversized softcover that had about 41,100 units. Their Wonder Woman Spirit of Truth Oversized softcover with about 35,200. The JLA Secret Origins Oversized softcover with about 33,900. We're noticing a trend here with oversized softcovers.
And I think we're noticing a trend with Alex Ross, are we not?
And original material. So, I mean, all three of those have, you know, so many things going for them. The fourth one kind of breaks that mold a bit, and it's the Sandman Endless Nights hardcover with about 26,400. So it was a hardcover, not an oversized softcover. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Alex Ross, and I'm trying to think if that was original material or not.
I do not know.
But those are the only four things that launched stronger than the Civil War trade paperback on record.
Okay.
And in some cases, significantly stronger. So, Civil War wasn't, oh my god, this is the best we've ever seen in trade paperback format, but it was still incredibly strong. Now, for comparison, the 19,200 units it did, let's put that in context. The average number of units for the top-ranked trade paperbacks or hardcovers for this month, for the top 100, is about 11,900 units. Now, the median number of units, and I'll explain what that means in a sec, was only 10,150. Now, the average is taking the total number of the units, dividing them by the number of items. The median is the value which half the items did equal to or better than, and half the items did equal to or less than. So it's literally the halfway point, which is why it's a little bit lower. Because in this particular case, Civil War did well over twice what the number two ranked item did, so it's statistically kind of skewing the average, whereas the median doesn't tend to have that problem. But again, it did about twice, you know, what the average, you know, of the top 100 trades did this month. So, again, strong selling book. Anything else you got on that, or should we move on to the next one?
No, I'm looking up Sandman, so why don't you go and I'll look it up real quick.
You are so diligent on that. That's great.
I'm trying.
Okay, the next three books all have something in common, and that's, of course, Civil War. The number two ranked book this month was Civil War Amazing Spider-Man. It came in with opening numbers of about 9,400 units. This is the second best opening numbers for Spider-Man Collected Edition on record. And it came in behind Ultimate Spider-Man Volume 5 Public Scrutiny trade paperback, which had about 9,800 units. So it was a pretty close second to that. Now, this is the only item in the top 10 selling Spider-Man collected editions on record featuring the mainstream Marvel or 616 Spider-Man. All the others of the top selling Spider-Man collected editions were either Ultimate Spider-Man or the movie Spider-Man. And the median opening sales for the 616 Spider-Man trade paperbacks seemed to be about 3,000 units. And this did about three times that, a little over three times that. So clearly it did pretty well. But again, essentially Civil War crossover, no big surprise.
You know, that's, pardon the pun, but that is simply amazing.
Yeah.
It truly is. I did not know until I'm reading your notes right now that that was the case.
Yeah. Well, again, this was one that I wasn't quite sure what to compare it against, so it's like, okay, I'll compare it against all the Spider-Man stuff and see what I could get. Now, another thing that I found kind of interesting about the top-selling Spider-Man trades is that most of them had no known reorder activity on the monthly top 100 trades lists. Now, that's not to say that those other Spider-Man trades didn't have reorders, but that this kind of shows one of the limitations of this data set, in that it only has, right now, the top 100, previously, a couple of years back, only the top 50, prior to that, the top 25, prior to that, the top 10, prior to that, no trades whatsoever. So we don't have a complete picture here, and the numbers I'm reading off here are, in a lot of cases, particularly over time, gonna be low. And we kind of get a little bit of a checkpoint for that at the end of every year when we get the top, you know, 200 or 100 trades or whatever for the year. But again, it gives us some context. All right, let's move on to that next one, number three, which is the Civil War Frontline Book 1 trade paperback. This one did about 7,600 units, which is far below that 19,200 that Civil War proper. And, you know, it's really a matter of perspective on this one, if it did well or not. mm-hmm. because in some months, these opening numbers of 7,600, that would have taken the top slot. So it certainly didn't do bad by any means. On the other hand, it came in at well under half what the Civil War trade did, and a few thousand behind what that Civil War Amazing Spider-Man trade did, as well as the Civil War Road to Civil War. Mm-hmm. So this one could have done better. It comes down to glass half empty, half full. Didn't do bad, but I don't want to say I'm surprised by the difference between this and Civil War itself, because on the monthly side, the same thing happened. It was just kind of interesting.
This book comes in at $15, okay? Yeah. And it's book one of two. So the next book is going to be $15.
Mm-hmm.
So that's $30 on Frontline. I think Marvel could have done an even better job if they packaged both of them together in an oversized trade and sold it for $25.
Or even if they'd done it at the 30.
Or even 30. I'm giving it a little price break for packaging them
together.
Fair enough,
fair enough. I'm just wondering if when we see that second book, I'm expecting it to fall pretty short of this 7,600.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at, yeah.
But then the trade-off is, if they had packaged it all together at once and it was a higher price point, would people have gotten it? I think you're right, if they'd priced it at that $24.99 like Civil War was at,
right,
that would have made it a lot more palatable, and since it came out the week after the Civil War trade, people
probably
would have
gotten it.
You're
getting more for your money. It looks like you're getting more for your money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been, yeah, I think you're right. I think that would have been better packaging. I wonder why they
but
didn't.
But being it's number three of the month, it's still not that bad.
True. Again, I'm not saying it's bad,
yeah,
but
no.
It comes down to incomplete data at this point because we don't know how that second book does.
Yeah.
And if that second book tanks in comparison to this, it may still do well. But if it falls more towards the 5,000 than the 7,600 or whatever, then I think they definitely would have been better packaging them together.
They could have made up the difference by packaging it together.
Exactly. Even right. if the combined book took a hit of 1,000 units or whatever.
Right. Yeah, they're still better off. Right.
Yeah.
Economics, my friend.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's, you know, we're looking just at these top three things. We had the Civil War at the $24.99, the Amazing Spider-Man Civil War 1 or Civil War Amazing Spider-Man, whatever, at the $17.99, and then the Frontline at $14.99.
Right.
There's not that big of a difference in the page count, I don't think. I'd have to go check.
No.
But, I mean, at times, it seems like there's no rhyme or reason to how much these things are costing. Because it's
I kind of alluded to that earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, their price points are all over the place.
It's not a matter of, it has X number of pages we're going to charge per page. And anyone who thinks that, not going to happen. Because these guys, I mean, Marvel has got to be paying more for J. Michael Straczynski to be writing Amazing Spider-Man, for Mark Millar and Steve Niven to be doing Civil War, versus Paul Jenkins and company doing Frontline. There's a lot of those things to be factoring in on cost of content production, you know, things of that nature. But that having been said, this next item kind of puzzles me.
Mm-hmm.
It came in, it was another $17.99 trade. It was the Civil War Fantastic Four trade paperback here at rank number four. And it did 6,800 units. This seems kind of low, given how much of an impact Civil War had on the Fantastic Four and how much the Fantastic Four impacted Civil War.
Exactly.
And given that Straczynski wrote a lot of this trade and also wrote the Amazing Spider-Man one, the difference of about 2,600 units is really interesting. Now, some of this Fantastic Four one was written by Duane McDuffie. Certainly not as big a name as J. Michael Straczynski, but for my money, a pretty damn good writer, too. And they had some really interesting stories. I really liked the one with the Thinker, which I am pretty sure is in this collection, although I'm not positive about that. So, for this to have fallen so far short of where the Amazing Spider-Man Civil War trade did, and just a little over, you know, about a third of what Civil War did, is really surprising. Now, this did ship near the end of the month, so we may see some reorder activity for it next month, which wouldn't surprise me at all. But I still would have expected it to have done a bit stronger. But, again, 6,800 for a trade, not bad numbers. So, you know, again, I'm not saying it did bad. It just, in comparison, you know, I would have expected better. Now, fifth slot, really interesting. $19.99 cover price. It is the first collected edition, I believe, for the All-Star line at DC. Mm-hmm. And that's the All-Star Superman Volume 1 hardcover. It came in at 6,700 units. That seems like pretty solid opening numbers. And I'm kind of thinking this is something that we're going to see on the list from time to time. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, yeah.
Have you read the stories in this?
No, they can't, you know. Is the Superman one kind of came out on time, didn't it? And the Batman one did not, is that?
Oh, God, the Batman one took a month between issues 4 and 5. Or a year,
yeah,
I mean.
A year, and they're still trying to get that out. But Superman came out every month?
I think it came out bi-monthly. It
bi-monthly.
Was not something you would want to set your watch by,
yeah.
But it's not something you needed to set your calendar by either.
Okay. Yeah, I do want to pick up this hardcover.
I think there was such a huge difference between All-Star Superman and All-Star Batman that it's not even funny. Because All-Star Superman is just modern Silver Age greatness. I mean, it's fun. It's a bit wacky in places. It's certainly, you know, classic Grant Morrison in a lot of respects. But it treats the older material with reverence and respect, yet still kind of pokes fun at it in places. Or I should say has fun with it versus poking fun at it. That's the better way to phrase it.
Is this going to be one of those seminal Superman books where people will say 5 years from now, you should pick up All-Star Superman, you know, as people say about Dark Knight Returns and Year One with Batman?
I don't know if it's going to be like that in terms of those are, you know, if you only read, you know, one or two Batman things, those would be the ones people are going to say you got to read.
Yeah, because there's not many books you can say about that about Batman, or Superman, I mean.
Yeah. I think there are a couple others, though, maybe. You know, Life and Death of Superman, or Return, you know, Death and Return of, that sort of thing.
Right, okay.
And this is kind of non-continuity, but against those Dark Knight.
That's all right, yeah.
I definitely think this is going to be one of those that is not going to be forgotten, is going to be potentially, not an evergreen, not a it keeps selling month in, month out kind of thing, but I would expect to see it at least on the yearly top lists, if not periodically on the monthly ones.
Okay.
It's one that I think may wind up flying a little bit below the radar, but will I would certainly hope it constantly turns over at the stores. It's good stuff and deserves to do that.
Okay,
number 6, Fruits Basket, Volume 16, graphic novel. This is one of them manga ones from Tokyo Pop. It did 6,600 units. That's down about 400 units from Volume 15, which is about 7,000. And honestly, I have no clue what to make of the sales trends on this series. It bounces around by hundreds and sometimes 1,000 or more units from volume to volume. It doesn't seem to have a clear direction up or down or even left or right. Or would that be right or left, since it's one of those, you know, traditional manga ones? I read a traditional manga book over the weekend or last week or whatever. It was the Cup Noodle one that was up for an Eisner.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot read books that direction. I had to keep reminding myself, no, I should be reading them in the other order. So that's why I don't read Fruits Basket.
Do you read the last page first, too, and go from back to front?
I watch them uninvent the Cup Noodle. I'm sure this is a good thing that Tokyo Pop's doing with this series. It seems to do routinely pretty well. It is out of, say, the top 10 or 15 items. Out of the top 15, it's one of two that I'm unfamiliar with. So please, people, forgive me for that. We have gotten one or two comments in the past that, oh, you should know all about these things. It's like, I'm sorry, I read a lot, but there is a limit. And backwards tends to be that limit sometimes. Which is no slight against the manga stuff. They should be doing it in the traditional format. I respect that, but I'm too set in my ways. I can't read that way. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's move on to
Let's move on. Let's go somewhere totally different. Civil War.
Back to Civil War.
Back to Civil War. This is why Marvel did so well this month. Slot number 7, Civil War X-Men. This trade paperback came in with 6,200 units, and this was the second lowest trade paperback so far that we've seen with Civil War in the title versus, like we mentioned before, in the subtitle. Now, it's not too surprising given kind of how removed the X-Men seem to be from the events of Civil War, and quite frankly, given what I thought of the series, I think these are pretty strong numbers. I'm not expecting to see this one back on the lists very often, if at all. Did you read any of that stuff?
No, I did read one or two of the next book, The Thunderbolts, but not the X-Men.
Okay, let's move on to The Thunderbolts. Did you like what you read?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. You know, they keep on changing the team. You know, I was a big Thunderbolts fan from the issue one.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, that thing
that
started
was a great.
That
was series. And, you know, then it kind of, I waned off of it. But when I found out that, you know, who the team makeup was and coming back to Thunderbolts and, you know, the dynamic of, you know, kind of like a heroes for villains for hire kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was kind of interesting.
They've been doing some good stuff with Thunderbolts. I was really blown away by that first issue way back when, because it was a complete surprise to me how that issue ended. And it just blew me away.
Oh, yeah. Oh, issue number one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's Kurt Busiek, because he did a wonderful job on how he promoted the series. He was honest. He was upfront. He was telling people what the premise was. Yet he left out that key hook at the big reveal at the end of that first issue. And if people had known that going in, it would have been, yeah, whatever. We would not still be reading Thunderbolts today.
Well, also, don't forget that issue number one of Thunderbolts wasn't their first appearance.
They
first appeared in Hulk,
mm-hmm.
and then they appeared in another magazine or another comic book. And then I think Thunderbolts number one was, and then they appeared in Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And so they popped up in a couple different places, and then they got their issue number one, and then there was the hook. And it's like, whoa, you know.
I thought they had pretty much showed up only in Hulk before the issue one, but that's 10 years ago, so I don't remember.
No, I think there was a Spider-Man, too.
Okay.
I think there was some kind of like a Marvel Spotlight kind of book. You know, Marvel show like a showcase book or
right.
A couple of short stories, and it's in the trade paperback. It's in the first trade paperback.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And again, like you're saying, they did a great job really setting up that group of characters before tossing them into their own book. Between that and the hook, that's why again, you know, 100 plus issues later, we're still reading about a lot of these characters. And I really think the way they were used in Civil War was just brilliantly done. It was a lot of fun. And I think this title took the best advantage and had the most interesting spin on the whole Civil War concept.
Right. Oh, Tales of the Marvel Universe. That's what it was in. And then Hulk 449. And
yeah,
then
I remembered the Hulk one.
Yeah, then they went into Thunderbolts number one. Yeah.
Okay. Now, this Civil War Thunderbolts trade did about 5,800 units, and this is the lowest one, the lowest trade we've seen so far, that has Civil War as part of the title versus part of the subtitle. And again, a little surprised by that. I think this is a good book. I'm a big fan of a lot of what Fabian Nicieza does as a writer. And I was really a little bit taken aback that they decided to change directions, characters, and creative team on Thunderbolts at coming out of Civil War, going into the Initiative. It'll be really interesting to see how that trade does when it comes out versus, say, this one. Okay, let's move on to slot number 9.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one I got a couple of questions on the pricing. This is Runaways Volume 7, Live Fast. It's a digest. It had a cover price of $7.99, and it sold about 5,400 units. Now, that is up about 700 units from Volume 6, which only did 4,700 units. That's nearly a 15% bump, which is really great. And Runaways is just a really fun series, and I'm liking it. Now, my question for you, Chris, is, I mean, clearly the low price point on these digests is really helping sales. But I'm curious, and I don't really expect you to know the answer to this, but I'm still curious, you know, on your views on this. I mean, how much of a difference can there really be in the cost of printing something like this as a digest versus as a normal size trade paperback? I mean,
that's a good question.
But is it so much cheaper they can go like half the price?
Well, it's half the size, really, isn't it? I mean, it is a digest size, and all the digests have the price point of $8. The Mary Jane one, the Spider-Man, the Power Pack have a one at $7. Runaways have an $8 price point, the $7.99.
Yeah. you know, if any of our listeners out there know enough about printing to you know, let me know, you know, kind of give me a feel for the difference in printing costs for, not necessarily exactly what Marvel's paying, because I'm sure they're getting the sweetheart deal, whatever, but just kind of an industry standard on what would the difference be between a digest-sized thing and if they had done this as a full-blown trade paperback, which I'm sure would have been at least $14.99, possibly $17.99. Is there really that much of a savings on the physical printing? I'm really puzzled by that.
I'm surprised that all the Spider-Girl trades are digest-sized.
Well, I mean, the size makes sense for the audience I think they're going after. They're going after the younger readers, so the lower price point, the smaller physical size makes sense. I mean, when I was a kid, I just totally ate up those digests that DC was doing with the Best of DC, the Blue Ribbon digests, back when Adventure Comics went to that format. And I think those were even smaller digest size than the ones we have these days.
Yeah, but I mean, when I buy a digest size, I mean, I buy SpongeBob for my son.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I don't want to buy Spider-Girl for a digest, you know. I mean, that's, you know, it's pretty much a grown-up title. It's a teen title, more or less, but it's still an adult title, I think. It's an all-ages book.
All-ages, totally, yeah. I'm really enjoying Spider-Girl.
For younger, for a digest, I'm thinking, like, when I buy SpongeBob or Justice League Adventures or Teen Titans Go digest or something like that.
So you're thinking something almost aimed,
aimed exclusively
at the younger, yeah.
Yeah, or like the Franklin Richards Boy Genius Digest.
I have a single kind of quote-unquote modern age, if you will, digest in my collection.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly...
The Star Wars Clone Wars adventure books, those are digest-sized.
Huh, I don't have any of those.
I think they're priced at...
Was the Star Trek manga, was that the same format? Oh, that's more of a manga thing anyways.
Yeah, it's more manga.
Yeah. I don't know that I have anything in that physical format. I should get something just to check it out. But with my eyesight going as it is in my, you know, advanced age, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for those oversized, you know, soft covers we were talking about earlier.
Right.
But I just... It's great they can do it at this price point. I hope it's saving them enough money, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just... It leaves me wondering if some of these other things are a little overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a horrible thing to say. But, I mean, let's look at slot number 10 here. $20 for a hardcover. It's Spider-Man Reign, premier hardcover edition. It did 5,300 units, and it was a four-issue miniseries. So I don't know that you're getting more content for that than you're getting in the Runaways book. It just seems a little weird.
Did this sell well as a regular monthly book?
First issue sold 46,800. The second issue was really wild because it jumped up to 65,400. But then with number three, it's back down to the 46,000 or so. And then with four, it went up to about 48,300. So it had this really, really interesting bump on that second issue, which is, you know, a second issue bump is practically unheard of, much less one of nearly 20,000. So it's one of those that I don't think my data's wrong, but, you know, I gotta wonder.
Right.
But you look at essentially, say, 47,000 average-ish, and it sold 53,000 here as a hardcover. That's not bad. That's pretty good. That's pretty strong. It's done well in the short term, no question about that. Fairly successful. And it launched into the top 20 best-selling Spider-Man collected editions, so that's good. But the question I have is this going to be a long-term success, or is it going to be something that's kind of quickly forgotten in a few years?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
You know, this is one, is it going to be a Dark Knight-ish thing or not?
That's how it was portrayed when it came out.
Oh, totally. If you read the story, it reeks of Dark Knight done, you know, spider style. In both good ways and bad ways.
Mm-hmm.
This was pretty well done, pretty well received. It's too early to tell how it's going to do, but it's going to be interesting if we keep seeing it on the list or not. I'm kind of leaning towards probably not, but we'll find out.
We'll see what happens when it gets into a trade.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, the trade should be interesting.
Yeah.
And frankly, it wouldn't surprise me if it does about the same in trade. Because we're seeing that in a lot of cases with a hardcover and the trade almost an even split, which is kind of surprising. But also goes towards, you know, why the publishers, are, particularly Marvel, are doing both hardcovers and trades. If they can sell both and do pretty well, why not? Well, that pretty much covers the top 10. Why don't we bounce around a little and cover the highlights of the rest?
Sure.
The next one I saw that looked kind of interesting is right there at slot 11, because, yeah, I went really far. And that's the Showcase Presents Legion of Superheroes, Volume 1. It did about 48,000 units. Actually, it did about 48,008-ish. And again, these are estimates, so the fact that I put a little 8 there doesn't really matter. But what I find just kind of sort of hilarious on this, and again, this is me being a number-crunching geek, but bear with me, it is kind of funny. This showcase opened at almost the exact median number of units that Showcase Present volumes tend to open at. The median value for opening numbers for a showcase is 4,813 units. This came in 5 shy of that. So this is pretty much middle of the road how a showcase does. Half of them do about this well or better, half of them do about this well or worse.
Right.
Which I think is a good sign, because hopefully we're going to see a full run of these Legion showcases.
Oh, there's so much material.
I would love it if they would just crank these puppies out. If for no other reason than I can, you know, actually show people, see, they only rebooted this thing twice. Legion gets slammed for getting rebooted all the time, and certainly the early stuff is just classic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have the archive run. I got hooked on these
back when they were being reprinted in the Adventure Comics Digests. And this is just great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we go down to that next showcase?
Sure. Showcase Presents Superman Volume 3.
Now, this is at rank 16 and did about 4,400 units. What I find kind of interesting is this had a sharp drop-off from that second volume. That second volume did about 6,000. This came in about 1,600 units shy of that, which is about a 26 or 27% drop. Now, I'm not alarmed by that because these showcase presents, I mean, this is a $17 book. You get, what, 500 plus pages. It's a hell of a bargain.
Right.
And not only is it a good bargain, it's 500 plus pages. That's going to take a while to read. I'm sure people are still working on the first two volumes. I say that as one of them. And by working on, I have them and haven't started, so it may take me a while. What's your take on this kind of a drop-off between volumes, particularly a second and third volume?
I think you're right. And also, I think it has to do with what else is in the top 10 and what's on people's budgets. I think Civil War took up a lot of people's money.
Yeah.
And now that Civil War is winding down, you're going to see a lot more showcases and a lot more essentials come up on the list, I think. Especially because both companies are cranking them out.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you're right, because if you've got to choose, gee, do I want to get the Civil War stuff, find out what's going on, or something that was printed a few decades back for Superman, you're going to go for the more current stuff. That, you know, that's the hot and heavy. That makes sense. That's a, that's a really good point. Where do you want to go to next?
We can go right to the essential Spider-Man Volume 8. And no doubt, you know, getting some publicity from the movie.
Oh, I would think so. This did 4,200 units, which is pretty good. Now, this is covering... So this has stuff by Len Wein, Bill Mantlo, Marv Wolfman, Archie Goodwin, Stan Lee. I mean, this is classic stuff. And you know a lot of the Spider-Man stuff, I hope, gets a good bump from the movie. We already talked a little bit about 300, which came in at rank 21.
Yep.
With another 4,100 units in reorders. Another one I thought might be fun to talk about, because you mentioned it on your podcast recently, was Batman and the Mad Monk.
Yep.
That trade paperback did about 3,800 units, which seems, yeah, I don't want to say low. I mean, it's strong sales. But, I think they really could have packaged this a little bit better, a little bit stronger, and, you know, because it really wasn't until I listened to your episode that I really appreciated that, you know, Matt Wagner was retelling a Golden Age story.
Well, he did the same thing with the Monster Men, too.
Yeah. Well, and they mentioned that in the solicits, but, you know, just kind of, oh, yeah, by the way, it's based on a Golden Age story, and then they move on to everything else.
You're right. Yeah, I thought Mad Monk made Monster Men a better story.
Yeah.
It was kind of like The Empire Strikes Back. It made, you know, episode 1 a better story. Well, and more well-rounded.
as a process junkie, I would have enjoyed seeing the original story.
Mm-hmm.
So having that pack... Now, granted, I read this in monthly, but if they'd packaged that in with the trade, that might have been enough for me to go get it.
Probably yeah, and not, I mentioned that in my podcast. There was no mention of Batman Chronicles or the Archives in either book in their ads in the back. And there could have been. Way to promote it. Yeah.
It's one that, if they'd done it right, they could have done some good cross-promotion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well. Maybe in an oversized hardcover, the absolute Matt Wagner Batman or something.
And if they don't do that, they're missing a huge opportunity.
Yeah, they are.
It's one that definitely could do well in that format. Rank 30, I tossed this in just because I thought it was funny. Spider-Man Black Cat, Evil That Men Do, trade paperback, came in at 3,100 units. And that's right, nearly 5 years after the miniseries started, the trade paperback is finally released.
Jeez.
Only did about 200 units, less than the premier hardcover did last year. So again, trades, hardcovers, almost an even split, it seems like. But that'll teach people to wait for the trade. Or monthly comics in that particular case, because I remember a pretty long wait, too. And then it's funny, because right below that, at fairly close, again, with around 3,100 units, is Absolute Batman Long Halloween. You know, that's a $75 price tag, but it sold just about as well as that that Spider-Man Black Cat trade at $15. So, you know, I don't think the price points are slowing people down on some of these Absolutes.
No, not at all. And Long Halloween is something that is easily available in trade form and hardcover form as well.
Yeah. Next thing that caught my eye was the Amazing Spider-Man Omnibus, Volume 1, that did about 2,800 units. And this is, you know, just great opening numbers for Marvel Omnibus. I believe it's the best that we've seen.
Mm.
And, I mean, I'm not too surprised by this. I mean, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, Spider-Man, I mean, come on. If this isn't part of the core foundation of the Marvel Universe, I don't know what is.
Yeah, and the Masterworks have been sold out for a couple of years now. So you could not buy this material anywhere else unless you really want to pay for it. But people just wait, you know, why pay over $100 for a volume one where you can just wait for the omnibus and pay $75 or whatever it was.
Yeah.
Or $99, $100, I'm sorry.
Or you can do what I did and pay I was going to say $50, but I got it for about $38 or whatever on eBay for the DVD collection that has the entire run of them.
Yeah, but I can't read my comics on my TV screen, though.
You're right.
We've talked about
it's,
that.
It's totally different, but...
It's different.
Even at $100, I think this is an excellent price point for this kind of omnibus because it's good packaging. It's well done. Next thing, shall we go down to that Marvel Masterworks Iron Man?
Sure, yeah.
That's Volume 4. That came in at about 2,500 units. It seems to be about what the Iron Man ones are doing these days. By these days, or every year or so when they finally bother to come out with another one. It's a little hard for me to compare these to the previous ones because they used to have the different price point for the new versus variant edition dust jackets and used to split them out. So the third volume of this, according to my notes, only did about 1,300 units, but I suspect that was only one of the two variants, and the other one just kind of fell off the list for that month, because the previous ones all seemed to be doing right around this 2,500. So this is a case where a bit better granularity on the data would be really nice. Then we got that Complete Peanuts, Volume 7.
Those continue to sell well, yep.
Yeah, 2,200, nice solid stuff. And $29 or $28.95 for this, that seems like a really good deal. What's the page count on these? Because this is one that eventually I might like to get the complete run of. I mean, Peanuts is just a classic comic strip.
Yeah, I've got Volume 1. They're really nice. Yeah, 326 pages.
300,
yeah.
Wow, 326. That's a great price for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got hooked on the Peanuts stuff when I was a kid. I'd be going to the doctors, and in the waiting room, they would have... I don't know exactly what collected editions they were, but they were hardcovers. They were, hundreds of pages. I mean, if I didn't know that these were just now coming out, I would have said it was these. But this would have been, you know, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, Good stuff. Down at rank 53, we got some reorder activity on that Civil War, Road to Civil War trade paperback of about 2,000 units. I'm thinking we're going to see, for the main Civil War trade, maybe the Spider-Man one, maybe one or two others, some reorder activity. Civil War itself probably is going to stay on the list for a bit. It's going to be interesting to see which ones stay, which ones kind of fall off. And speaking of what stays, what falls off, and whatnot, at rank 55, we've got Will Eisner's Spirit Archives Volume 21. Now, this is doing 1,900 units, which is down around 100 from Volume 20. And while the opening numbers on these seem to be cooling off, I gotta suspect some of it's just the collectors getting a little bit lax about continuing to pick these up, because, I mean, even after 20 volumes, this thing is still selling, you know, close to 2,000 units per volume at the $50 price point.
Yeah, there's gonna be 24 volumes in all.
Yeah, it's just amazing. I mean, a lot of trades and collected editions can't do this even at a fraction of the price on a first thing, much less a 21st volume. So, but I mean, Will Eisner's Spirit, I mean, that, again, classic, you know, legendary material.
Mm.
I was actually at San Diego when not only they made the announcement they were going to do these, Will Eisner actually signed the paperwork for Paul Lovitz there at the panel.
Oh, very cool.
So that was neat. Next one, you talked about quite a bit on your podcast. And
yeah, Agents of Atlas by Jeff Parker and Leonard Kirk.
1,700 units. You think this is high? You think this is low? What do you think?
I think it's about right, but I think for $25 and getting 250 pages worth of material and classics Atlas era material is a bargain.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think these are low numbers, but I'm disappointed in them.
Yeah.
I think Marvel just went all out on this hardcover. They included a bunch of stuff they really did not have. They could have just done the 6 issues of the miniseries.
Yep.
Charged it at this and maybe done the same numbers. The fact they put in all those bonus features and don't seem to have really gotten a bump in sales from that, really disappointed. I hope that Marvel continues to do that when they can and when it's appropriate, because I thought that was just a really slick move.
This is a real hidden gem. And I would not be, if they ever do a trade of Agents of Atlas, it'll probably be just a 6-issue series.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because when you were going over all the other stuff they were putting in this, and I was thinking, you know, I've got the 6 issues, but I mean, that other stuff sounds really cool.
You know, I have it too. It's a really cool book.
Yeah, I may pick that up. I don't know.
Yeah, it's worth having.
Yeah,
especially if you're into history like I am.
It just seemed like, again, they took a risk, they did something out of the box, added some extras. I really would have liked to have seen them get rewarded for that.
Mm-hmm. And it will. I mean, Parker even mentioned he wouldn't be surprised the year from now if it's nominated for a book award, some type of award, reprint award.
If it's not in next year's Eisner's for Best Archival Collected.
Yeah, an Eisner or Harvey Award or something.
Something.
You know, yeah, it's definitely worth it.
I mean, that's, again, one for just the way they packaged it. They deserve recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And then directly below that in the next slot at 59 is that EC Archives for the Weird Science Volume 2.
Mm-hmm. Another book that came out of the 1950s.
Yeah. And again, about 1,700. Now, what was interesting on this is it had a drop-off of only about 75 units from that first volume. I mean, that's negligible.
Mm-hmm.
That's you know, a couple of stores deciding, oh, I'll get one less or whatever.
Right.
So I think that's really stable sales. And it's funny, you compare things like the Weird Science Archive there, the Agents of Atlas, the Spirit Archive, and then you look at some of these things that fell beneath that in the list. You've got the Hawk Girl trade paperback, which only did about 16,000 and was probably lucky to do so. You know, and then you get a couple of the things that are either some reorder activity or whatever, or just things that aren't selling bad but are new and potentially couldn't, theoretically should be. I don't want to say should be, but you know what I mean. Newer material the audience or the readership is aware of, it's getting blown out of the water by some of these other projects, which is really interesting to watch. Was there anything else that really caught your eye, looked interesting?
I think that'll do it.
Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. I always enjoy it.
Oh, this has been great, John.
What's coming up on your podcast? Anything you want to hype real quick?
Let's see. I just recorded this week, and I went over the Fantastic Four and Silver Surfer trades just in time for the movie. So
good deal.
That's on my plate. Yeah. So keeping busy. But I like doing this conversation every month that you and I have. So
yeah, well,
it's fun.
Definitely keep doing it. And if you've got other things you want to talk about in terms of what trades are going on or anything else in comics, you're always welcome over here. Of course, I'm sure you keep busy on your podcast. What with all that research and stuff that you do? It pays off and it's good because
I
swear, you know, I don't get a lot of the trades. I mean, out of the top 100 here, I've probably read the contents of about 40 or so of them in the monthly format.
Mm-hmm.
But listening to your podcast, I get a much better appreciation for things like the Agents of Atlas or the Mad Monk, things like that. And I think that's great. What you need to do is investigative journalism to find out what's going on with that Showcase Presents Who's Who we were promised a year or two back.
You know what? I should. That's a damn good question. I'm going to write Alex tomorrow.
I want that. Well, once again, my name is John Mayo. I've been your host here on the Comic Book Page podcast. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is podcast@comicbookpage.com. Thanks for listening.